Hi, I'm Lorraine Rapp.
And I'm Linda Lowen.
Welcome to Take Care, a weekly conversation on health and wellness produced by WRVO Public Media. On today's show, there's fungus among us, or there should be in our diet. If you're not eating mushrooms, you may be missing out on a natural food source that contains anti-inflammatory, antibacterial, antiviral, and immune-enhancing properties. A registered dietitian covers the benefits of mushrooms from the ground up.
But first, most of us look forward to a good meal, whether it's home-cooked or out at a restaurant. But for many, the enjoyment is tempered by worry that even the smallest bite of the wrong thing can set off a digestive attack.
Heartburn or acid reflux that's persistent or interferes with daily life could be the sign of something more serious, like GERD, gastroesophageal reflux disease. What causes these digestive conditions? And can modifying your diet be enough to keep it under control? Joining us for a look at GERD and other digestive problems is Dr. Rajiv Jain. Dr. Jain is chief of gastroenterology at Texas Health Dallas and a partner at Texas Digestive Disease Consultants. Welcome back to Take Care, Dr. Jain. It's great to have you join us.
Well, I am pleased to be back with both of you and your listeners. It was a pleasure last time as well.
Before we talk about acid reflux disease, would you explain exactly where acid comes from and what its role is in the body?
Sure. The main function of acid really is two things. One, it was a way to kill bugs. So if you can think of early man out there foraging and eating stuff off the land directly without cooking it, its main job was to kill infection. And then the other big thing is that acid also helps to break down protein, and so that way it can help absorption of those nutrients in the small intestine. So the acid, again, the big thing is to kill bugs and to help break down protein.
What you're saying then is essentially, hopefully, we're exposing ourselves to fewer bugs and infections now that we're in a more sophisticated society. And a lot of our diet is not necessarily proteins, but carbohydrates. So could we live without stomach acids?
No, I think you can live without stomach acid. For example, there are some patients who have stomach cancer or some other disorders of the stomach, and the entire stomach is removed. And so you can live without it, but acid also is needed for absorption of important vitamins like vitamin B12. And it's a little complicated pathway, but so acid is important for many things. The primary two things were to kill bugs and to help break down protein, but vitamin B12 absorption and other things. But what's interesting is when we think of acid reflux or GERD, as you mentioned, most people think of it as they're making too much acid, and that's what's causing the problem. But rather, it's not an overproduction of acid. The real defect in acid reflux is this muscle between the esophagus and the stomach called the lower esophageal sphincter, or LES. And actually what's happening, all of us should have some amount of regurgitation and reflux of contents from our stomach. But what makes acid reflux a problem or symptomatic is when that muscle relaxes either too long and or too often and then allows acid contents from the stomach to come back up into the esophagus.
Yes, it does seem that there's just too much acid is the problem, but it's just that it's getting into places where it doesn't belong and, you know, it can really burn. But even if that muscle relaxes, some people experience it in different places. Sometimes it comes all the way and people describe something like heartburn, for instance. And another symptom of acid reflux can be a burning closer to the stomach itself. How does the acid make it up that high to some people where it feels like heartburn? Other people experience a different sensation. Is something different physically going on?
What's very interesting is that there really is a wide range of symptoms that can occur even with the same amount of esophageal acid injury. So one patient may experience extreme burning sensation in the midline of their chest after they eat, while the next patient with the same amount of acid reflux barely notices anything or just gets a twinge. Some patients will get chest pain. Sometimes the acid reflux can, even though it may be going up to the same level to the top of the esophagus or the end of the back of your throat, some patients will even get hoarseness, chronic cough, There's been some association even with asthma at times. So it's really amazing the amount of the variability of symptoms, even with the same amount of acid exposure. We don't really understand why some people feel it more and some people feel it less.
Well, this is interesting because if it's simply acid going to places where it doesn't belong because of that lower esophageal sphincter that you mentioned, then what relationship is there to food? Because I know that there are some foods that trigger in different people. Is that what causes that muscle to relax? What's the relationship with acid and eating the wrong foods or the trigger foods?
Sure, and I'm going to answer both your questions. I'm going to start first with something you brought up that was really important. Is that we, even though we call it acid reflux and we talk about heartburn, the two classic symptoms of acid reflux are a combination of heartburn and or regurgitation. So heartburn is sort of that burning sensation behind the chest. And the reason it's called heartburn is sometimes it's difficult to distinguish from heart pain or chest pain or angina. And so that's very important in our patients who have heart disease risk factors and or known heart disease, that we try to figure out which is causing those symptoms. But the other component of acid reflux is regurgitation. And regurgitation is the movement of those contents from the stomach, both acid and non-acid, that can cause a sensation of something coming up your chest. So there are patients who actually don't have acid coming up, but have food contents coming up, and that causes that sensation of regurgitation and discomfort. So there's both acid and non-acid reflux. In terms of the why that happens, again, we don't really understand it, but for some reason, that lower esophageal sphincter, that muscle, opens up and lets things come up and down. Now, we all tell our patients that things like alcohol, smoking, chocolates and fatty foods, things like that would make acid reflux worse, things additionally like caffeine. But what's interesting is when you look at really high-quality studies, they're not able to show a clear connection between improved symptoms. Now, I'm practical with my patients. I tell them, if something clearly makes you feel bad, then don't do it. So if there's certain food triggers, 3 cups of coffee that make you feel bad, well, then cut back. But I don't think patients should go across the board and eliminate all potential triggers of acid reflux.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Take Care, a conversation on health and wellness on WRVO Public Media. I'm Lorraine Rapp.
And I'm Linda Lowen.
We're talking to Dr. Rajiv Jain. He's chief of gastroenterology at Texas Health Dallas and a partner at Texas Digestive Disease Consultants. And what we're talking about is something that millions of Americans suffer from, and that is acid reflux. So we're talking about that it might be very individual that certain foods trigger acid reflux in some people and not in others. And it's patients that you're talking to while you're being so practical. Instead of giving them a very limiting diet, you're just telling them, play it by ear. If it's 3 cups of coffee that gets you, cut back to 2, which is probably a good idea for people to kind of monitor what they're doing. What are some other situations that might bring on symptoms of acid reflux unrelated to eating?
The biggest reason we're having more and more acid reflux symptoms in this country, unfortunately, is the obesity epidemic. And there is a very tight correlation with acid reflux symptoms and increasing weight above your ideal weight. So one of the first things I do with my patients is I look at a thing called their body mass index, or BMI, which is a combination of their height and weight. And using that calculation, you can tell if they're just overweight or obese, and or if they just tell you, you know, hey, I gained 5-10 pounds over the last year. I think one of the first important things to do for patients, independent of food intake, although I guess it is dependent on food intake, is to lose weight in those patients that are overweight or obese, because not only is it tremendously beneficial for their acid reflux symptoms, but it affects their overall health in so many different ways that I think that's the most important thing to do. Now, most of the other things we tell patients to minimize acid reflux, unfortunately, go back to the way they eat. And so, for example, you know, we'll tell patients not to eat or drink any intake for 2 to 3 hours before they lie down, because really gravity is your friend. When you're upright, food goes right down the esophagus into the stomach, and, you know, after an hour or two or three, it's further beyond that. And so if you eat or drink and lie down, you're more likely to get acid reflux. And one of the other measures that patients can do is to raise the head of the bed 2 to 3 feet to, again, use gravity as their friend. Now, when patients do this, they shouldn't just put 2-3 pillows up to raise the head of the bed, because what they're doing in that situation is basically they're crunching their abdominal area, and that's actually increasing what we call intra-abdominal pressure and will make it more likely to have acid reflux. Rather, what they should do is either buy one of these medical wedges. It's like a foam wedge that goes up about 30 degrees, and they can put that under their mattress, or they can just simply put a couple bricks under the head of the bed, and that'll raise it up at an angle. And those are sort of less expensive ways of increasing the head of the bed. And another interesting little fact is that when you lie on your left side, your stomach is more dependent or below the esophagus and the junction between the esophagus and the stomach. But when you lie on your right side, more of the stomach is at the same level or above the junction of the esophagus and stomach. And so it makes it easier when you're on your right side to have acid reflux. So again, I'll tell a lot of my patients, if you're going to, you know, when you lie down, lay on your left side, you're less likely to get acid reflux then.
When a patient comes into your practice, it sounds like a lot of the diagnosis is based on patient reporting what they're experiencing, what they're feeling. Is there anything that you do, any sort of testing that you do, and beyond all of the common sense treatments that you've talked about, which are, you know, non-invasive, is there a point at which you do have to prescribe medication?
Yeah, I think, as you mentioned, the first thing is that having the classic symptoms of burning in the chest and or regurgitation is usually the way we make the diagnosis way over 90% of the time. And it's in those patients that are having more frequent symptoms than, let's say, 3-4 times a week, and as you mentioned earlier, that's affecting their quality of life and things like that, we always try to find out what their triggers are and limit that, try to lose the weight. And if they're still having more frequent symptoms that don't respond, let's say, to antacids or other over-counter remedies, or they're having to take the antacids several times a day, daily, those are patients that I will give them a trial of a stronger medicine that we call proton pump inhibitors, or PPIs. And examples of those include omeprazole and lansoprazole. These are medications that came out in the late 80s, and they're very strong and they, in terms of suppressing acid in the stomach. So again, we're not improving the muscle to minimize the reflux. All we're doing is trying to take out the acid or the burn injury from the contents that are coming up. And so those are those patients that are having more frequent symptoms, and I'll prescribe them either an over-the-counter medication like omeprazole or a prescription strength. And frankly, I tell the patients they're all the same, this class of drugs that we call proton pump inhibitors or PPIs. They're all the same in terms of how well they work. To me, it's how cost-effective I can be for my patient. And so you can take the over-the-counter one. It will say, do not take this for more than 2 weeks. That restriction is only for patients who are not under the supervision of a physician, as we have patients on these medications for years if they need it. So again, to your question, I will put a patient on these medications typically for 4 to 8 weeks to see how they respond. And if they get tremendously better, that's a great sign. Now, I try to limit the use of these medications because, as most of your listeners know, you go see the doctor, you get put on a prescription. When do they take you off of it? Rarely. And so in acid reflux, if somebody comes and sees me and they're 35 years old and they hadn't been having too many symptoms, they gained a little weight, they're trying to lose the weight, but they can't, they're still having a lot of symptoms, I'll give the medication for 4 weeks, 8 weeks, maybe 6 months. And then I try to wean them off the medication if they've lost the weight, and or just to give them a trial to see if they can get off medication so they're not stuck on something for the next 40, 50 years.
Yes, I know a couple of people that have been on PPIs for 10 years or more, and frankly, they're doing really well. But some of them are in my own family. But I don't understand how we can function as well without acid in our stomach. And you mentioned what the role of acid is, but there has to be a downside to not having acid production, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. And you make a great point. there is no medication that we use that has zero side effects. We're fortunate in that this class of drugs that are typically prescribed, the proton pump inhibitors, that they are generally very, very safe in comparison to the other medications. But there are some potential side effects, and the big ones are the following. There's been some data for loss of bone density or osteoporosis. And so we don't have to stop the medication if somebody has osteoporosis, or we don't have to give them extra calcium and vitamin D, but it's just something that we have to be wary about. Some of the newer studies show not as significant decline in bone density as the original study showed, but it's just something I go over with my patients. The other thing, as I mentioned, you need acid to absorb B12, vitamin B12. And again, we don't routinely test patients for their vitamin B12 level before and after we put patients on this medication, but it's, again, something that we think about. To me, the more important side effect that's been associated with this medicine is an infection in the colon called Clostridium difficile, or C. diff for short. And all of us in our colon have millions or billions of bacteria and fungi. And when we suppress acid, it changes actually the bacterial milieu in the colon and increases the risk of this infection. Typically, this infection called C. diff is seen after antibiotics, but it can cause really difficult to control diarrhea that requires other treatment. So particularly in our hospitalized patients who are on these medications or proton pump inhibitors, we try to minimize their sort of standard use on every patient that gets hospitalized. And the reason they're getting that in the hospital is to prevent ulcerations while they're hospitalized.
Dr. Jane, we have very little amount of time left. I just wondered, is acid reflux ever treated with surgery as a last resort?
Yes, acid reflux in patients that have symptoms that are difficult to control with proton pump inhibitors, we will refer them for surgery called a fundoplication, where the surgeon takes the top part of the stomach and wraps it around the end of the esophagus to tighten that muscle and keep contents from the stomach coming back up in the esophagus. We're, again, fortunate that with medication, we can control these symptoms in over 99% of the patients. So very few patients require this surgery. I would like to mention one important thing, though. Acid reflux, there is an association with an increased risk for esophageal cancer. And the in-between point between long-standing acid reflux and esophageal cancer is Barrett's esophagus. So I think it is important for those patients who have long-standing or very symptomatic acid reflux that they get under good control, because the studies show that if you have long-standing acid reflux or poorly controlled acid reflux, your risk of developing esophageal cancer goes up.
Dr. Rajeev Jain is Chief of Gastroenterology at Texas Health Dallas and a partner at Texas Digestive Disease Consultants. Thank you so much for explaining acid reflux to us.
Well, Lorraine and Linda, it was a pleasure to be with you both, and look forward to talking to you all again.